Hello, everybody. Welcome back to part two of this extended feature-length Survivor extravaganza. If you are confused about what's going on here, I would recommend checking out part one and listening to the introduction there where I set this up and explain what's going on. Or don't. You guys never listen to me anyway. But if you do stick around, I hope you enjoy what you hear as we move on to part two here discussing Survivor storytelling. To tie this back to the storytelling, there's a wider issue over whether the story you tell has to be believable, ultimately, because you can get viewers to suspend their disbelief or to maybe come around on people that they were skeptical about before or vice versa. But sometimes if you just don't have the raw material to work with, it's hard to put the pieces together in a coherent way. So like with Parvati, for instance, I look at the screen and I'm turned off by her attempt to charm people. But I know in practice, she's very good at what she does and much more mentally resilient people than me have fallen prey to her charms before.
Sure.
So who am I to say anything otherwise, right?
Sure.
But there are other people who, like, I don't get it. Like, it's not even like, I don't get it, but I see what other people do. It just doesn't seem plausible to me as a viewer. It's like the script is deficient in some way.
Do you know who I never got? Sierra from Token Sheens. I feel like Sierra from Token Sheens, to me, the way that they depict her existed entirely in other people's descriptions of her. People would go on about her like she was the most annoying, irritating person on the entire planet. And I knew that there must be something that she was doing to engender people feeling this way about her. And I could, like, kind of look at some of her interactions with people and be like, yeah, she's kind of a drip. But it never went more beyond like, yeah, she can be a little bit of an annoyance sometimes. But I never got whatever character that they were trying to construct with her through the second person accounts that people gave of her. I never quite saw it.
So when you think about a season of Survivor as, it feels kind of hacky to call it a text, but let's go with that for now.
Sure.
To what extent do you think the authorial intent matters at all? So if they are clearly pushing a certain character or storyline in a way that doesn't really match up with how you receive the story, has something gone wrong there? And if so, with who? Who takes the blame for that?
There's a certain amount of taking my own stuff from a text, if that's what you want to call it. There's a certain amount of taking my own stuff from a text that I am willing to do, because there are things that will be of granular interest to me that won't necessarily be of granular interest to everyone else. Okay, for example, I've always thought that Monica Culpepper was a fun character to do a deep read on and kind of extrapolate things that weren't necessarily presented about the way that she interacts with the world and how her role is this kind of rich lady whose concerns seem primarily domestic and who is challenging herself in a particular way by being out here that's super meaningful for her and super life-changing for her, but maybe kind of pales in comparison to some of the concerns that someone like Vetus, who has been addicted to heroin, or Sierra, who's a teenage mother, or other people who have had these very, like, capital letter big problems, maybe find a bit off-putting that she's putting this much weight on the fact that, you know, Monica's out here doing this for Monica, or however she wants to put it. Like, that is, like, a deep reading of the text that I'm doing that I don't know is necessarily something that Survivor, the apparatus, set out to convey with this season and this depiction of this woman. With that said, like with Ghost Island, there are all these people going, wow, Chelsea's really great. And I'd be like, how the fuck do you know that? It's like, she's not on the show. I'm sure she is great. I'm sure that most of the people on these shows are great. But I feel like there's a certain amount of, If the authorial intent is to obliterate a certain character, that I can find it hard to get past. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, I guess I'm thinking more of the people who do show up. So like with Samoa, for instance.
Sure.
I don't know if we're meant to see that as an advanced screening of just why Russell can never win Survivor, or as an example of how,
and should it matter,
of how Russell should have won Survivor but was cruelly deprived of that by these bitter Galoo members. And then
I'm not gonna let them tell me that Russell should have won Survivor and sit there and have to believe it. Like, I think that if that is your, like, I mean, I don't really know 100% what they were trying to communicate with that particular edit and that particular season. Do I think that they, the people who make the show, Probst, whoever that is, feel like Russell should have won Survivor that season? Yeah, I think probably they do think that. But I think there is or could be an equally good tale to be mined there. I mean, I would personally move around the pieces. I would give Natalie White an actual personality in the edit. I would, I don't know, I probably needed about 25, 30, 40 fewer Russell confessionals along the way. It's easy to play.
There have been some fan-made recuts of Samoa where they do just that. They strip out a lot of the Russell airtime and they give it to basically anybody else that they can find.
That's a nice thought. And so that's the thing is that, like, I think that it's hard for me to know where the line is because I can watch a Rob Mariano season, maybe not Redemption Island because there's not really any reason to watch Redemption Island, but I could watch a non-Redemption Island Rob Mariano season without furiously jerking off to Rob Mariano the way I'm sure the show would ideally have me do. But when you get to a season like Redemption Island, it's not even so much a question of do I respect the authorial intent or not. It's that they have left me with nothing else. Like, if you are not watching that season for Rob or Philip or Russell, then why are you watching it? Because there's nothing left.
And I think with most good seasons, there are different interpretations that you can have. So to me, it's a mark of a good season if I can think that someone else is wrong about the best way to perceive it. So Vanuatu, for instance, we might describe that as the Yasser sisterhood disintegrating from within, and then like Mario Lanza can describe it as the revenge tour of Chris, and like he's the focal point of the story. So
right.
I would still defend like my stance on that, but I can see where he's coming from, and I can see why the people who buy into Chris, which I mean, I like the guy, we've spoken to him, but I still don't, in the context of that season, it seems so insincere to me, and I still don't fully get it. But if you do, then you have something that you can buy into.
I mean, it's who you come in relating to, right? Like, if you're Chris's general type of, like, these broads are nuts, but I'm going to do my best. Like, if you're that guy, then that's maybe the lens that you take coming into that season, right?
I guess so.
It just depends on... it depends on what kind of like consumer of the show you are and what kind of person you are and all that. But I do think that there are some seasons, and Redemption Island is the one that I'm using, but there are others where if you are not in it for the reason that the show is spoon feeding you, then for me as a viewer, it is too much work to completely fabricate some sort of alternate reading of it just to say that I have so that I can glean some enjoyment from the show. So there is a line. I don't know exactly where it exists. I think most seasons of Survivor, even the didactic ones, exist comfortably on the side of the line where you can pull your own interpretations and find your own interesting things about certain characters who may not be as prominent in the edit or whatever. But there are some seasons where it's literally just like, okay, you've given me this on a plate and either I like it or I don't.
It's also, I think, increasingly hard to evaluate a season in isolation because a lot of them now have returning players. So you have history there by default because you have people who have played before, and also those players between each other have some kind of history that you need to reference in some way. But also, even on seasons which have all newbies like Ghost Island, you're seeing these callbacks and these nods to the show's history, which in theory are good and to be encouraged, but the presentation of those is very simplistic, can lead to this like hijacking of the story which moves everything in a new direction. So what are you making of the increasing like self-referentiality, I guess, of the show?
I think there was a time when I found it novel when you would get the occasional mention, like John Mish would drop a Jatiya reference or something, and I'd be like, oh, I like Jatiya. I'm glad to be reminded that she's out there in the world. But now, like, I mean, if you, like, obviously something like Ghost Island is the logical extreme of that, where you've got the stick and it's grown powers or, you know, whatever it is. And it's weird because It's very much a show that is now in the stage where I was going to say it's trying to build its dynasty, but it has built its dynasty. It kind of goes against what you were saying earlier about how, like, they're trying to make it a show where you can jump in at any point and, you know, it doesn't matter if you've seen it from week to week because they'll give you the goods in the previouslys and everything else. They'll just, Missy will tell you that she's had 3 divorces every single episode, right? But then you're also expected to know who these returning players are or why it's significant that someone has won as their reward a meeting with Cochran, stuff like that. And it kind of seems to work at counter purposes. I don't know that I really feel one way or the other about it, except that I think that I, in general, prefer if callbacks to previous seasons are limited to returnee seasons. I think that's kind of my preference, but I don't actually care that much. Like, it's clearly what the show wants to do, so just do it.
Yeah, with Ghost Island, it felt like you had someone giving a book report every episode on the Cliff Notes version of some previous season, and that's fine. I'm glad that someone who has joined the show in the last year or so gets to experience that for themselves, and maybe now they're inspired to go back and catch up on what they missed. But it feels like it's very kind of ceremonial, for lack of a better word. It's like, we'll kind of go through the motions here, and we're giving you the highlight reel and our own very editorialized version of that highlight reel. So we're going to allude to these big moments because we think some player made a terrible mistake, even though if you go back and you check it or whatever, it made sense, or like you can see how they can very quickly just put a spin on something and now that's the official canon, and it's going to be very hard to contradict that at all.
The my favorite example of that is when they were doing the second chances vote, and Jeff Varner, his clip that they used was that he jumped off his stoop in that immunity challenge for peanut butter and then got voted out. And he was like, "You remember me? I jumped off the thing for the peanut butter. People ask me all the time if I still eat peanut butter." And I'm like, "Nope, da 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 da." And I'm like, there is not a person on the planet who remembered that the circumstances of Jeff Varner's boot was that he jumped off the stump in that particular challenge for peanut butter and then was arbitrarily chosen as the tribe was he on? Kucha. He was arbitrarily chosen as the Kucha person that they were getting rid of, and it came to a tie, and then there was a tie. Like, it had nothing to do with the peanut butter, and no one has ever said that it was about the peanut butter. No one has ever mentioned Jeff Varner and peanut butter in the same sentence. I bet now he wishes that they would. But it was just one of those things where I was like, oh, okay, this is something that you've literally constructed out of thin air as your means, like, propagating this player that, like, was never the perception around this player. So
just out of the blue. Returning to the show's kind of metagame, if you like, its relationship with its own fans has developed in this weird way over time, and especially the self-proclaimed superfans who are guaranteed to be on every season now, and the show embraces them to a point, but is very willing to cast them out and trample over them if they don't fit some kind of value system, right? So you can be Cochran and end up as officially venerated by the show, or you can be Jacob Derwin or Max Dawson, or in the worst case, Dan Foley, and the show will dredge up actual footage for the first time in history to bury you live on national TV.
Oh my god. Yeah, I mean, Max Dawson got his shot at coming back, so it didn't, like, he was potentially in the conversation, whatever that meant. I mean, it's just whether you're lucky enough to be that nerd, right? Like, it's whether...
Yeah, it's almost like there's a demand for competence. If you're a super fan and you do well and you make good TV and you give us what we want, we'll allow the fact that your fandom is a little bit over the line. But if you're just that weird fan who can't even do anything right, then we don't want to sit with you. Like, we don't want anything to do with you, and you're in the game is entirely your fault.
I mean, I think that... I don't know if I necessarily read it that cynically. What I will say is that Survivor is increasingly prone to casting people whose story for the show is effectively that they have a cluster of panic disorders, or are severely anxious, or are struggling with this or the other thing that kind of impedes their ability to socially engage with the situation around them. And like, at the best end of things, you get like a Cochrane who, I don't know, Cochrane, they still give a very particular edit to a Cochrane. However, he wins. You get an Aubrey who comes out, has her initial salvos of whatever her anxiety disorder is, overcomes, finds her footing, takes on challenges and earns the respect of the people around her and the viewing public, right? And then the flip side, or David Wright, kind of same thing, has Hannah, half the fucking cast, millennials versus Gen X, excuse me, same thing. But then the flip of that is that you get someone who gets voted out second. You get Jacob set up the first however many episodes as being like, look at this goof. And then the rest of it is the journey into the journey until you are looking suave at the reunion and Jeff Probst can be like, so you're getting a lot of girls now, Cochrane, or whatever the hell dumb dad question he asks. I don't know. It's I don't know that I have a lot of concrete thoughts on that other than like, You plumb an archetype long enough, some of them will catch fire and some of them won't, and they seem very into like super fan with panic disorder right now.
Well, on that point, it used to be this rite of passage that the Kathys and the Hollies of the world would go out there, melt down in dramatic fashion on day six, and then rebound from that and learn and grow and come just as close to winning and fall just short. And that was an archetype in and of itself. And I don't know if this is some variation on that, or if we now have the vocabulary to describe something that was going on the entire time, or whether because it's a different group going through that, we like assign different labels to it, or exactly what's going on there.
I mean, I think that it has a lot to do with, I think it has to do with changing opinions and perceptions of mental illness. And I mean, I think that like Kathy Sleckman from Micronesia is maybe a good example of this, because she is someone who was depicted as being fairly eccentric, fairly sheltered, socially inept, and kooky, for lack of a better word, and that was kind of her bag. And she has since said like a million times over that what actually had happened was she had gone out there, gone off some critical medication, and was having a seriously rough time out there from a mental health perspective, to the point where it became imperative that she left the show and got back on her ship. And like, how useful would it have been to have a name to put to what was going on with Kathy, rather than her just being this like goofy, awkward, wacky lady who out of the blue lost her shit one day and quit like 12 days in. But I think that like the conversation, the public conversation around mental illness has changed. And I think that has to do with social media. I think that has to do with the way people, and particularly young people, but not exclusively young people, because this is something that was part of David from Gen X, right? That was part of his story. And he was, I think, in his early 40s or late 30s, or he was in, I just think that the conversation maybe around mental illness has changed such that like, you're telling me that who's the first person whose anxiety or depression or whatever it is was openly acknowledged part of the show? Was it like Aubrey maybe?
I want to say it was actually. Yeah. I can't think.
You're telling me that like, no one from the 32 seasons prior to her had any issue? There was one person, it was the lady from Fiji who had a panic attack right before the show and couldn't do it.
Oh,
so they did it with 19 people.
Yeah, Melissa McNulty. But I guess
sure
she wasn't, I guess, like, she was written out of the show because,
oh, that doesn't count. Yeah. No, that's yeah, exactly what I'm saying. Like, she's that is a footnote. That is a name that literally only you and I would know, because most people don't have any idea this woman exists because she wasn't on the show. And so I think that there are many people in early seasons who must have been going through shit to do with depression, to do with anxiety, to do with any of these like fairly common mental illnesses that plague people. And it's just now the conversation around it has changed such that there is a vocabulary around it. But if you're telling me that like Holly Hoffman or Kathy or whoever it is could have been going through some shit mentally out there, yeah, that scans to me as plausible and likely.
Yeah, I see. I don't know if it's meant to be understood as a one-off reaction to being in these incredibly unusual circumstances, or if when someone like David or Aubrey go through it, it's meant to be, this is an issue that I deal with regularly, and it's amplified by being in these incredibly unusual circumstances. So I guess the con is kind of different there. But the as one final question before I let you loose, sure, on Dawn Meehan.
Oh God, yes.
So or whoever else you like, really.
Sure.
So within the show's own mythology, I guess, it's always been the central conceit that this is about survival. And a lot of the marketing in the very early days focused on that. That was always one of the things that the show was understood to be, is you strand these people on a desert island. That's the premise. They're not in some penthouse suite on The Apprentice.
Sure.
Looking back, I wonder if how like historically fair that really is, because if you watch Borneo, that's remembered like unkindly as they just sat around and talk about how to make fire, mm-hmm, all day, and that's, sure, really not the case. Like, it's surprisingly, no, strategic, it with surprisingly modern vocabulary for that.
Yeah,
and you look at what they're doing, they're just lazing around in raincoats all day. They're not suffering, they're not trying to cope with that part of the experience. But then you watch Australia or Africa or Marquesas, and that's when that focus on that really happens.
Sure.
And then by, yeah, the time you get to these cinematic experiences in Pearl Islands, that's not really acknowledged explicitly anymore. So if anything, that felt like a brief historical interlude, and yet that's remembered as the kind of descent that the show took, where it used to be all about that, and it's been slowly declining over time.
Which I don't know that I agree with necessarily. I think that the focus of it has changed, but I think that by and large, most of the instances in which a tribe has been super fucking hard up have been things that the seasons that you're talking about, Africa, Marquesas, Outback, yeah, for sure, totally. But I can also think of like, God. Anytime, like, I think Foa Foa has some scenes, or Matt Singh has scenes where they're just getting like fucking beat down by the rain. They're far more inclined to just drop you on a fucking island by yourself now. There's these markers of suffering that people go through now that I don't think they necessarily did before, that I just think are kind of not emphasized. It's not emphasized as much because the focus of the game now is primarily strategic, but I think that by and large, the average modern survivor player probably has a worse go of it than the average, you know, whoever was on one of the early seasons where they at the very least had like a dedicated supply of rice or manioc or, you know, whatever it was.
Yeah.
I get that there is a production function from starving these people as much as you can because it generates stress and arable conflict and makes people hazy or whatever it is. I have, as a rule, very little interest in watching people physically suffering. I think that it's probably my least favorite part of the show, is that they're out there on this island and like losing a fuck ton of weight. And the flip side of that is someone like my grandfather, who thinks that they literally should not be voting out people or doing strategy on the show. He thinks that they should be dropped on a beach and they should all fucking like drop dead one by one, and Rupert should be on every season and winning. So I guess it depends on who you are, but I'm less compelled by the actual strategy component of it, which, I like you say, my favorite season is Borneo. They weren't really doing that bad out there. Like, they were, I mean, they all lost weight, certainly, and they were sleeping in the rain and shit, and it was probably a very shitty camping trip, all things told. But I don't think that the primary interesting thing about that season is that they're all super gaunt and dying day by day.
Yeah, it feels like the show has moved past the point where it needs that as part of its mythology.
Yeah. Oh, and it used to be like a location-based travelogue kind of show, and that part of it has been winnowed away as they have to look at like budgetary concerns and the realities of like making a fast food version of this show that has lasted almost 40 seasons. We can't find two new countries to film this in every single year. Like, there's a lot of things about the early presentation of the show that have sort of like fallen by the wayside. The designation of tribes, tribal council, all of, like, this kind of weird, hokey, tiki bar orientalist stuff that was the predominant set piece of the show in the early going has, like, largely become just embedded in the show's terminology, but isn't really explored in any way. Like, there's lots of stuff about it that is just kind of part of the set dressing now.
What qualities do you think Survivor has that makes it either especially well-suited or especially poorly suited sometimes to telling particular types of story?
That's hard to say because I think that the things that Survivor once did well, it doesn't, and I think it does different things now. I think that in its earliest iterations, and specifically in its earliest iteration, I think that Borneo is a very interesting story about as diverse a group of able-bodied heterosexual white people as you can get, trying to navigate each other and feeling things like animosity and guilt, and it's all framed in a very literary, highly symbolic, very storyized way that I find very interesting. So in its earliest iteration, I feel like it did that well. I feel like it did similar things with Diminishing Returns for a while. I think that Outback is a not as good version of Borneo in the sense that, like, I think that there's some interesting stories and some well-drawn characters. I think that I love the way that Jerry is drawn as a villain. It avails upon a lot of kind of femme fatale tropes that if you're, you know, examining it from a feminist lens is questionable, but also how can you, if you don't fucking love Jerry, you don't have a soul. I'm sorry. I, you know, whatever. Anyways, that's that. But it'll do interesting things. Like there's like in the fourth episode, at fourth or fifth, and my details are fuzzy here, but there's some scene where there's like a wildfire and it's encroaching upon both camps and it's literally doing different things at different camps. On the Ogacore side of things, this is right when they're in the shitter. So I think they've just voted off Mitchell at this point, which would make it episode 5. At the Ogacore side of the things, this fire is essentially the circumstances of the game bearing down upon them. They're two in the hole against Kucha. They're facing down the barrel gun because effectively they need to win. Kucha needs to lose two more members for them to have a shot at the merge. And of course they do, but we don't know that at this point. And then the fire diverts to Kucha, but its function there is it's chasing the pig that Michael kills through the camp. Michael's been, for the past fucking 3 episodes, he's been fucking around trying to kill this pig, which, by the way, I still can't watch the pig scenes. It's too, like Colleen Haskell, I'm bummed out by the circle of life.
Is that because of the impending death of the pig, or is it just the identity of Scoopin' in 2018 that colors everything in retrospect?
God, I forgot about that. Nah, it's just the gory pig shit. I have a soft heart. Scoopin. What a piece of work. Abby Maria got him with that coconut, though. Once again, Abby Maria on the ball, right about everything. And I will, to my dying day, Abby Maria, she had that fake idol. You can't tell me any different. But anyways, point being, there's this wildfire that's doing narrative duty, pushing out this pig that Scoopin's been chasing forever, and then he catches the pig and he guts the pig and everyone has whatever reaction they have to them. And of course, the next episode, he goes down into a fire. So it's not, I'm not saying that like the Survivor editors, and by the way, the episode where Scoopin' goes down in the fire and the whole sequence and the way that that's cut is fantastic work. It's great television. Like, it's super harrowing and moving. The way that they do this long stretch with like no confessionals and just this kind of like grim didgeridoo music happening, it's really, really good. And so I guess what I'm saying there is that, like, it's not that these people are out fucking setting fires and planting pigs and being like, oh, this is really going to contribute to the story that we're trying to tell. It's just that I think that in that particular era of the show, the people who were constructing the narrative on a large scale had a really good grasp of things like symbol and things like metaphor, and they were kind of frequently incorporated, and sometimes they worked and sometimes they didn't. The Black Widow interspersed with Jerry's face, maybe a little bit on the nose, but in general, I think they had a really good idea about like what was visually and narratively interesting about the things that were happening to these people. Because once you meander into like Marquesas and Thailand, I'm a bit less fond of the show. It keeps a more languid pace, but it stops doing the cool narrative things that I'm interested in.
Yeah, that might be a good way to divide things up, because one of the things that Survivor fans love to debate is when different eras of the show started. And often that's thought of in terms of the game itself or various twists or casting trends or things like that. Editing, I suppose, as well. When it comes to storytelling, how would you break that down? And do you think those divisions are clear at all?
I can tell you exactly. I can tell you exactly when it changed, because I saw it happen before my eyes. When I was rewatching all of them, it changes in Amazon, because Amazon is a Pearl Islands type story that is initially told with the pacing of a Thailand, and it doesn't work, because when you start introducing Rob Cesternino and the fucking gorgeous barrel of psychos that populate the Amazon cast. And this is just a quick aside. Amazon succeeds as a season because it has no compunction about making everyone look as awful as possible. Yes. There are so many arguments that are happening. My favorite example of this, and I was just thinking about this today, my favorite example of this is there's some scene at Jabiru, which is just a fucking great train wreck of a tribe. There's some scene at Jabiru where the pretty girls, Heidi and Jenna and maybe Shauna, are like just sitting on their ass, doing nothing, feeling their oats, and maybe even like monologuing a bit about how fucking pretty and great they are, like they're Cinderella's wicked stepsisters. So they're already coming off like fucking tools. And then out of nowhere, fucking Joanna comes in from off screen with this just like long screed about how like beauty fades, but the woman who believes in the Lord is righteous and resilient. And she just goes off on them being like, the Bible says you're fucking vapid airheads and I'm going to heaven and you're not, in so many words. And it's just one of those interactions where I was like, I really appreciate how entertaining that interaction was, because I was on nobody's side. It was just something that washed over me like a wave and then retreated back into the ocean. And I just now I am damp. I just really appreciate it.
Joanna Ward is someone we all need to talk about more often, in my view.
Bring back Joanna. Okay, you know what? Let it be known. If I can evangelize any point, it will be this. Here's what I understand that there's maybe bring back a few returnees kind of season coming up. Here's what we do. We scrap whoever those people are. We're bringing back Joanna Ward. We're bringing back Laura B. We're calling Colleen out of witness protection. Call her up in Guam. Is this Isabel Sampson? Yes. We know who you are. You're coming back on the show. And the fourth one can be Abby Maria. And that's who we're bringing back on. So if I can plant anything in anyone's head, we need to start tweeting CBS to bring back Joanna. Anyway.
Is there anybody on Amazon who actually comes out of it looking good? I guess maybe Christy at a stretch, but I'm struggling to think of anyone otherwise.
I don't know, dude. Christy? I say this as someone who likes Christy and who sincerely empathizes with her position. Because it's not the most... It's a fairly self-interested cast that she got stuck with there. And Christy's a grown-ass lady who has navigated the world as a deaf woman for however long she's been alive, because she's, I believe she's been deaf since birth, although maybe I'm mistaken, I don't remember. But I have a lot of respect for what she did out there, and I like her. With that having been said, the entire Christy Boot episode is basically just a roast on her for being like super fucking arrogant and just milking the swing vote thing so hard that everyone got fed up with her shit and decided that it was not worth the trouble and just voting her out. So I think that like maybe Christy comes out kind of the best.
Like, it's weird because I think Christy was meant to be sympathetic, but at this point they were so used to just dumping buckets of shit on everybody else that just spilled onto her, and they didn't know how to do it properly.
I feel like maybe Matthew vaguely redeemed himself, but there was also a lot of footage of just everyone like actively afraid that he was gonna murder them.
Right. I guess if you're that way inclined, Dina is an icon who is everything you want to see in the world.
Bring back whatever I said, we're doing five tribes, bring back Dina too. Dina's great. I think that I have a lot of respect for Dina for being an uncommon sort of ball buster who, even still, I don't know that we'll get a Dina again, which is a shame because I really like the way that she played it. I feel like Dinas excel specifically on female tribes. The sort of Dinas, the Amy Cusacks, the people who see these younger women around them and are like, yes, I can yoke you and ride you to the finish. I think that that is the environment that foments a Dina or an Amy, who I also really like. I think Amy's a great character.
We will talk a lot about Amy. Don't worry about that.
Oh, sweet. So I have completely gone off the point, by the way, which was that Amazon tells a Pearl Islands type story, but without the mega theatrical Pearl Islands apparatus. And you can see them kind of playing around with new types of editing when they do these fucking Saved by the Bell dream cams of Daniel Liu, you know, mooning over Heidi's smile or whatever they end up doing. So they're trying some new tricks. They do joint confessionals. They do the whole Roger episode where everybody knows that Roger's going home and they don't particularly obfuscated in any way. So they are trying new things, but it's still the pacing, the scoring, the presentation of a Thailand or a Marquesas or something. And then immediately the next season, you go to, and this is kind of my favorite era of Survivor from like an editing perspective, you get islands and it's so cinematic. You've got these cut screens with the pirate maps. You've got like really intense orchestral Pirates of the Caribbean blood pumping music. The way they've shot the challenges is completely different. The like musical flourishes that they do to denote a person or a thing that has happened are completely different. And I think to me, that's the cutoff point is, I guess it's a brief one, up until about Palau. They're doing like a certain kind of thing.
Yeah, Pearl Islands is great because there's no subtlety whatsoever. They just fully embrace everything in their mission statement, and it shows in the final product.
I maintain that if you have to pick out any, if you have any sort of sweet tooth for melodrama, like actually, well, very well done melodrama, Rupert Boot episode. Fantastic. Starts off with him like in this lightning storm trying to psychically communicate with the angel Laura B, and it's not where he's like having this fucking meltdown about how he needs to ensure that everyone finishes in places of honor, which is of course this like it's like the world's most megalomaniacal sentiment. How can I kill all of my cult members in a way that they won't hate me? But he's just freaking out about this. And then you get into like all of the machinations, the gears start turning to do the Rupert Boot. And then his last immunity challenge is this dart game killer, and he gets killed. And then they've got him like hacking at these rotten coconuts, and there's the fucking snake that's eating the entire iguana or whatever it is. And it's just this it could not possibly be communicated more vividly that Rupert's about to get done by these evil Morgans and Burton and John and the ungrateful Lil and whatever you want to say about these people. But it's a fantastic, it's just drenched in whatever it's drenched in, but I love it. I could watch it over and over.
It's amazing. Yeah. But as you alluded to, this is not a linear path, and it feels like at some time between like All Stars or Vanuatu, there's a kind of reset where we go back to some of that old school feel. So bridges a gap uneasily, but Guatemala certainly feels like a very old school season. And there's not much else about it to really distinguish it. I know there are lots of fans who view it as a cult classic, and I'm disposed to it myself. But if you're looking at it in the broad sweep of Survivor history, it feels like it could have been slotted in really at any point in like 2001, 2002, and you couldn't tell the difference.
I get where you're coming from. I think a lot of that has to do with, in my opinion, I think a lot of that comes back to the physical environment of it, because they all get fucking done by that opening hike. Eh? Like it's 11 miles or whatever it is. They get to the end. Bobby John is going exorcist. His eyes are rolling in the back of his head. Everyone's like writhing on the floor. Margaret's, you know, Florence Nightingale handing out sips of water and whatever. And I feel like because of that, and because the elements are so aggressive, it's particularly heat, it's aggressive heat and exposure, right? I feel like the energy of the season is slow. People are not thinking as fast, as aggressively, as urgently as they might. They're not really moving that much. It's not a season with a lot of movement. You get a lot of, like, over at Nakum, you get a lot of people just kind of, like, splayed in repose in the shadow of this temple. It's not a season that moves very much other than the challenges, but then the challenges drain the people, and then they go back to camp and they lay down. And when you're laying down and you can barely think and you're just trying to get enough water and corn mush to get through your day, you're like, okay, I could do my fucking triple cross front side, or I could vote out this 94-pound girl who's a magician's assistant and is an easy vote. And so you get a lot of, like, unanimous votes. You get a lot of people slowly not moving, and you get a fairly unadorned strategic game until kind of in the post-merge it picks up a bit. But other than that, I kind of get what you're saying. Like, yeah, it vibes slow. It vibes like it could be like a Marquesas or something.
Yeah, and somewhere in there you have Vanuatu, which I want to return to at some point, because it has a very unique feel, and yet I can't really place it in one era or another. It feels like it's marking some kind of transition, even if I don't know what from or what to necessarily. And then moving ahead, I guess Panama, Cook Islands, Fiji is where somewhere in there, like the start of the modern Survivor is usually identified. Does that align with what you think, or would you place it somewhere else?
I think that up until... I don't know that I attribute a particular look at... Once you start, it's like up until about heroes versus villains, I don't know that I would attribute any common look and feel to those seasons other than there's a familiar set of faces that you might see. You might see Amanda Kimmel, you might see Parvati, James, Suri, you know, those people. But other than that, I feel like China and Fiji and Cook Islands don't really feel anything alike to me. Micronesia and Gabon don't feel anything alike to me. You know what I mean? I feel like that was a pretty... And it's kind of the only era in Survivor that I feel that way about, per se, because I feel like the era that we're in right now feels pretty of a piece. I feel like Cagayan to, I don't know, Worlds Apart feels pretty of a piece. Obviously, that one fucking dark patch where Russell was in every season waving his dick around feels very of a piece. But I don't know that I attribute a particular era to that point, other than, like I say, you'll see some like Amanda seasons in there.
Sure. So in terms of the internal structure of any one season, do you think the way that they approach that has changed over time? Because it felt like back in the day, they were more willing to build up these storylines over time in a way that was as... I guess there was less serialized, whereas nowadays I think they want to assume that people can jump in and out. And if you miss a previous episode, the previously on segment is going to catch you up, and we're mostly going to be repeating the same things anyway, so you're going to get more of the same, roughly. Yeah. Whereas I feel like back in the day, you could skip a week and feel kind of lost going forward, which is not a good position to be in, but from a narrative perspective is almost something that you have to maintain.
I think that, and I mean, I agree with you, and, you know, whatever they have been on TV since, I mean, I said it before, since I was in elementary school. So obviously they have some notion of whatever apparatus they're working with, right? But for me, I think that the way that you've described it is actually really apt. I think that my favorite Survivor characters and my favorite Survivor narratives are not high concept. They are fairly complex. And if I were to sit down and explain to you why I like an Amy or a Dawn or whoever I like, it would be because, like, if I'm explaining to you why I like Amy, for example, I'm like, oh, because she uses, like, a lot of pretty, touchy, feely, ostensible kindness and sisterhood and good humor as a smokescreen for, like, some serious emotional terrorism vis-a-vis kind of Colorado barista yogi language, blah, 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 blah. And I can go into the whole thing. Whereas now I feel like the way that characters are synthesized and the way that we are expected to receive them is like Ben has PTSD. Missy has been divorced 3 times. Spencer has not said I love you to his girlfriend. And this is somehow something that we can stretch over 14 episodes of television. And like you say, they assume that like you will get Spencer saying, I haven't said I love you to my girlfriend, I haven't said I love you to my girlfriend, I haven't said I love you to my girlfriend in 4 different episodes. And whatever my gripes with this dude Spencer may be, I don't think that he's I don't think he's that big a robot that he's going to be out there repeating that over and over. He's been prompted to say that because, like you say, they're assuming, oh, this person maybe hasn't seen the last 8 episodes where Spencer says he hasn't said I love you to his girlfriend. And the way that it is presented somehow pegs that as like his sole motivation. Whereas to bring it back to Borneo, all the way back to the very beginning, which I think is the most ambitious and complicated narrative they've ever told, the bond between Sue and Kelly is only ever explicitly meditated on in one episode fairly near the end, where Sue gives some like pretty intense information about how like, I have not had another female friend since my very good friend fucking died 10 years ago today or whatever, like some really intense contextual information that suddenly makes the whole bond between Kelly and Sue, which up until now has existed in subtext, make a lot more sense and carry a lot more weight. But that won't be mentioned before that, and it won't be mentioned after that. You're expected to consume it as part of this larger narrative because you already know what Sue is like because you've been watching Sue for the last 10 weeks, right? And so I feel like that kind of gets to the heart of what you're saying, which is that like now it's a lot more, the story is contained within the episode. And the only thing that you really need to know is that Jeremy, Spencer, and Tasha are in an alliance. And we'll tell you that up front in the first 10 seconds of the previously. So you don't need to worry.
Let's talk quickly about the nature of the game as it pertains to the storytelling, because I know that you don't just focus on Survivor, you analyze other shows as well. And a lot of other shows submit to a different kind of textual analysis, if you like. Whereas sure. With Survivor, you have this elephant in the room in the form of the structure of the game, which can't really be ignored. And nowadays, yeah, that just is the focus of the show explicitly. Mm-hmm. So for other shows, you have a bunch of kooky people interacting with each other, and maybe there are incentives added into the show to guide things in a certain direction. Mm-hmm. But in Survivor, everything is funneled through the basic inevitability of every 3 days you have to vote someone out. What does that mean?
Sure.
How do you think that the basic structure of the game and its relationship to the story has changed over time? And I guess as the game has changed, how has that changed too?
Sure. I think in like very brief terms, I think that now the game plays the people, and I think that previously the people played the game. And my context for that is, if you look back to this kind of middle era of people that I was talking about, where you can see the kind of more frequent recurring faces, the Parvatis, the Ceris, et cetera, these are people who, here, we'll use Parvati, Ceri, Sandra, and Boston Rob. Those are easy picks. Those are people who have a particular identity to themselves in their games that most viewers will be familiar with. They play a game that is native to their personality. Sandra can't play the game that Boston Rob plays. Boston Rob is this young, brash, cocky construction dude who can build a fucking good shelter and has some sort of hold on people, whether it's based on demographic reasons or whether it's based on his personality, that people want to be his Ometepe girls, right? Sandra can't do that. That's not the kind of person Sandra is. But Sandra has a remarkable read on people. She can lie with a stone face like that. She has a very good knack of quickly figuring out what a person wants from an interaction and giving it to them, even if it's completely insincere. She knows what Russell wants from her, and she can just lie and give that to him. And she also has this great thing she does where she will be brutally honest to you, and in so doing, deceive you that she is only capable of honesty. She'll call you a fuckhead to your face, and she'll be doing some shady shit over there, and you'll be like, well, Sandra's not shady because she called me a fuckhead to my face. Ergo, she's not double dealing on me, which we know to be a lie because Sandra double deals all the time. Parvati is a super charismatic person. She's a flirt. There's a certain label of femme fatale and temptress that people assign to her as though it covers the entire complicated spectrum of things that she is doing, and it doesn't, but that is a label that I feel like she actively courts 50% because it is an appreciable thing for her to hide behind, and 50% because I think she kind of enjoys it. And then someone like Sari is like just an incredibly charming, likable person with this vast capacity for manipulation and one of the most remarkably creative, strategic brains. Like Rob Mariano can go out there and brute force that same, I'm going to whip you all into shape. Don't talk to the opposing tribe. I'm going to tell you all I'm final two with you, blah, 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 blah. He can go out there and run that game 10 out of 10 times, and sometimes it'll win for him and sometimes it won't. Russell Hands will do his, I'm going to get three stupid blonde girls. He can do that game till the cows come home. He doesn't have another chick in his bag. Sari has invented shit out of thin air. She will make you give her your immunity necklace. She'll do the 3-2-1 vote, all that shit. So these are 4-5, I guess, because I checked Russell in there, different people with different games that are born organically from their personality. Now, I feel like people are sort of, if you look at the extreme being something like Ghost Island, where there's a fucking legacy advantage and Dominic has three idols and you've got to steal a vote and you've got to give me a vote and you've got to let's trade our votes and you've got to, the jury can vote, but they can only vote on a Tuesday and they've got to write it upside down. Like, you have to be playing that game. You have to be playing the advantage game. You have to be playing the hidden idol game. That is what will deliver you to success most of the time. And I think that is why we see such similar games and such similar winners now.
And I guess that ties into casting as well. So if you have people who are meant to fill these predefined archetypes, then insofar as your personality connects with the game, you have the same personalities connecting with the game in roughly the same way. And sometimes people transcend their archetypes and they kind of move beyond those boundaries. And maybe it's reductive in the first place to try and lump all of them together. But I think when you do that, you have this kind of homogenization of gameplay, which you have to then enliven with these increasingly ridiculous twists that just get inserted into the game every week.
And I think this all started with a sort of Game Changers is maybe when this kicked off, because they had this season with Worlds Apart. They had the Kagayan season, right? And everyone loved it because it was full of volatile personalities and fun and kind of these extravagant theatrical players like Tony and Cass and Wu and Tasha and Spencer and Trish. Like, it was a personality season, right? And Jatia and all these people. And they kind of rode that for, because of the acclaim of that, they kind of just ride whatever their most recent season of acclaim was for a little bit. And then they did that until they got to Worlds Apart, where they cast people that the audience didn't like. They had Rodney and Will and Dan and all of these people who the audience were like, these are misogynist pieces of shit. We didn't like this season. You thought we were going to like this season, but we didn't. They hyped up Second Chances as though, which I always call Game Changers and it's not, they hyped up Second Chances as though it was a very well-received season. And I think it was because it was very strategically naughty, like naughty with a K-N-O-T-T-Y, naughty. And there were things that happened that were perceived by virtue of their novelty to be good. And I'm mostly just talking about the Kimmy boot here. That and then later you get like a recurrence of this with the Cereboot. And I feel like that is kind of the era we're in, which is like the more rules and the more advantages and the more potential for something like that to happen dictates a good season. And I feel like the reception to Ghost Island was pretty lukewarm. And that was obviously just like an orgy of advantages and weird gameplay loopholes and shit. So I'm thinking that maybe we're going to be moving out of that.
Towards what though? What do you think is the next
phase?
I don't
know. I think it will depend on, like I say, I think it will depend on whatever the next critically well-received season is. And if they were to do a 16-person back-to-basics, no idols season, which they won't, but if they were to gratify that corner of internet nerd and it ended up being a huge success and everyone on Twitter was filleting Jeff Probst that it was the best season they'd ever seen, then they would do like 10 of those in a row. If they were to do a returnee, all everyone returns season, and that got huge pop, they'd do that 10 times in a row. Like, I feel like that's kind of how the eras of Survivor nowadays are dictated, and it's sort of feedback, social media, is Jeff Probst ear on the street kind of hearing based.
Yeah, and that direction I think is as inscrutable as it's ever been, and I think it might be less so the general hive mind on Twitter or the mythical man or woman on the street, usually a man as it turns out, and more so just like one of Jeff's celebrity friends texted him an opinion, and that now is canon in Survivor
Tyler Lore. Perry.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So maybe we're going to see a much more erratic development of that over time. But who's to say? So that general idea of the game as a vehicle for the story, I think that's essential to making Survivor interesting a lot of the time. Because even if you're casting interesting people, just having them lying starving on an island by itself doesn't generate interpersonal conflict, it doesn't force tough choices, it doesn't force those interactions. And I think the game is at its best when it tries to marry those two as closely as possible. So like one example that I'm not sure if you read about, but I often gets brought up is like Russell and Parvati's weird like psychosexual drama being conveyed solely through idol ownership, basically.
Yes, love it. And fucking Russell would shoot a blank, he'd play his idol wrong, and Parvati would just like simper over to him and be like, well, you really fucked that
you
one
wasted
up. And you could just see it get under his skin,
withering disdain. Yeah. And
yes, exactly, whereas she would like basically whip out her huge dick and put it on the table by giving Jerry and Sandra her idols that he had no idea about. And then he would be livid. And then later on, Sandra pulls an idol out of their bra, and Russell and Parvati, neither of them know about it. And now it's a menage. And of course, those are our final three. So yeah, that's good shit.
Yeah. And in that case, maybe that's not something to encourage because it is based on twists. But if you go back a few seasons, I think you can find lots of examples of the game heightening those simmering tensions and then being the way that those are conveyed to the audience in a captivating way. Yeah.
Absolutely. And I'm not, to be clear, I'm not anti-twist, and I'm not anti-hidden idol. I think that the worst thing that the hidden idol does right now is there's too many of them, and I think it acts as a vehicle for a lot of samey-same. I'm looking under a tree. The tree told me to go over to the water. If you've seen Thai Hunts for an Idol once, you've seen it a million times, right? But other than that, if you stick to like, one hidden immunity idol for each pre-merge tribe and then one after the merge, I have no problem with that. I actually don't mind hidden idols. It's just kind of the way that they are now incorporated into the game. I love mashed potatoes. Like Stephanie Faber, I love mashed potatoes, but I cannot eat them all day. I need something else.
That's a deep cut. I like it.
Thank you. I'm always... That's the Stephanie Faber Nation. That's my people.
Absolutely. But I think the more modern seasons do offer a useful, if depressing, contrast there, where I think when the game gets decoupled from those relationships and it is just about a list of names, as you would put it, or about finding out which advantage slots in which position or whatever, then the narrative as itself loses that cohesiveness. Because I can follow these relationships over time. I can understand why, going back to Borneo, Sue and Kelly had this unlikely friendship, and then that blossomed into something more interesting, and then collapsed horribly towards the end. And the game was the way that collapsed ultimately. Whereas you look at Ghost Island, we just got off the phone for hours with Dom earlier. Fascinating guy. But on Survivor, all you see is him saying, I have a legacy advantage, I have an idol. Yeah. And any connection to the humanity of himself or the people out there just seems lost.
It becomes like a very complicated math problem, not a math problem, but like a statistics problem almost, because...
And not a difficult one, right? Because there's the basic structure of Survivor mathematically is trivial, but it's the way that people, the ways that people find to explore that structure via each other is what makes it interesting.
Yeah, and it's not inherently interesting to me. I think that there are people to whom it is inherently interesting in the way that something like chess is inherently interesting. There are these combinations of things that you can do, and it's about outsmarting your opponent with the resources that you have in front of you. I get it. It's not my thing. I like you and more about like how do these people express their conflict, the fondness for each other, whatever things they've got going on in their head through the mechanism of this game, Survivor. And I feel like that gets cluttered when you have too many... magic tricks that you can do.
Yeah, and looking at Ghost Island as an example, I understand because I'm told frequently from watching the show that Dom and Wendell are connected, but I, even though I like both Dom and Wendell as people and as characters, I don't know what attracts them to each other. I don't know what that friendship is really based on, where that spark initiated. Or Wendell and Laurel, for instance, the defining friendship of the season, that won Wendell $1 million. And what that friendship represents is important for a lot of viewers, and yet we basically don't know that it exists or why it exists until it serves some incidental role in the story eventually. So it feels like things only spring into place when they're needed. And so I don't care when they arrive. It's just, I notice that they're there, but I never move to wonder why or to investigate that any further.
I agree. And I think that like the other thing that sort of hinders Ghost Island is that the people who aren't playing with a full hand essentially become inconsequential. I don't know who Angela, it's when you get to the finale, I don't know who Angela or Sebastian are. I don't really know who Libby or Jenna were. Because their entire function were they were these kind of formless chess pieces that Dominic and Wendell and their alliance kind of just knocked off along the way. You get one fun fact about each of them. Desiree was homeless. You know what I mean? Like the way that I've described Ghost Island in the past, and this might be a deep cut, but I'm sure anyone who listens to a Survivor podcast has a decent chance of picking up on this. It's like a Brant Steele simulation.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean?
Sadly, like I do. Yes.
It's like you click through and you're like, oh, Bradley got voted out 5-6. Okay. Click. Oh, Chris got voted out and someone played an advantage. Okay, click. Desiree's gone. Okay, click. And there's nothing. I don't care that Desiree has gone, because even though from the limited amount of time I've gotten to spend with her, she seems like an affable and perfectly lovely person. It's not play fair, be nice, as Colleen walks out the door.
Yeah,
right?
I don't know why I'm meant to be impressed by Dom running circles around Desiree if I don't know who Desiree is or what her motivations are. And we on our regular episodes, we enjoy just analyzing the strategy in a lot of detail. But to me, that's not interesting because it's list of names on a roster and you move these different pegs around. It's thinking, okay, so Dom is getting slightly paranoid because he has this misconception about this person based on someone else exploiting his weakness for whatever. Like that, to me, that's what makes it interesting. It's why the numbers are where they are instead of just that they are where they are, which I think is what strategy is conveyed to be by the show nowadays.
Exactly. And like grand example, Game Changers, Sandra snipes JT by eating the sugar. Like that to me is a perfect example of like, that is something that Sandra was crafty enough to do based on her knowledge of JT and Michaela, and based on our knowledge of JT and Michaela as people and the conflicts between them, it makes perfect sense. And then Michaela and JT get in their scrap, JT gets done, he leaves, Sandra cops to having eaten the sugar, and we all laugh. And that's the end of the episode. And you feel something about the people who have done this thing because it relies on who they were, and it couldn't have been done by any three random combination of people the way that playing a legacy advantage.
Right. Someone pointed out with Ozzy in the context of Game Changers that before that season, he had this like, accidentally perfect three-season arc.
Perfect
right,
arc.
Where he, the first time around, he's crushing the challenges. He's the best challenge competitor that the game has ever seen, but he doesn't have the social side of this thing figured out, so he's going to need to improve on that. Comes back from Micronesia, everyone loves him, he's the cool kid at the table, still doing okay in the challenges, but he doesn't have the strategy nailed down, and that's his eventual undoing. So we got to fix that. So he comes back for South Pacific, and it looks like he's on track to patch all those holes, falls just short yet again. But you can identify how he comes so close in so many ways, and yet just falls short. And then for Game Changers, he's just an athletic guy who gets voted out post-merge. It could have been anyone. It could have been 100 different Aussie remixes from throughout the game's history.
Yeah. Chuck a dart at someone with long hair. Could have been any of them.
Even as an Aussie fan, I'm not sure what you had to get out of Game Changers. And that goes for anyone, really. Like, as I'm sure we are both massive Suri fans, I almost wish she hadn't come back. I rejoice anytime she is on my TV screen, but they try to make me make an exception for her.
It's such a shame with Suri and Game Changers. The one thing I will say about Suri and Game Changers is there was something very gratifying about her friendship with Michaela that I really enjoyed. I liked those two together, and I thought that I don't know, you don't typically get depictions of like black female friendship on Survivor. I thought it was really cool, and I liked them together. That having been said, I don't think it contributed. One, it didn't contribute in any real way to my appreciation of, understanding of, or evolution of Suri's character. Number two, they did this shitty thing that they do with Suri, where they try to play it like the big important thing about Suri is that she got off the couch and she's so inspirational. When in my mind, the most important thing about Suri is that I think she is naturally the most charming, cunning, like, I think if you had to pin someone as like the person who is most naturally suited to whatever psychosocial component of this game makes you really good at fucking dancing people around like puppets, it's Suri. She's like the smartest, most charming person who's ever been on the show. And so I feel like when they do shit like, oh, Suri's been out there trying to cross the balancing beam, let's put on those soaring strings and everyone clap when she cries, like, who gives a shit?
Yeah, when Suri hopefully comes back for a fifth time, she would love it if everyone thought that was the basis of her story, that she's this plucky underdog who somehow got off the couch and managed to shamble her way onto Survivor. Whereas
sure.
In reality,
it's a good smoke
that
screen.
Was the truth for like 3 days in one season. And after that, she was a ruthless mercenary who was...
After that, she was like a mob boss. Yeah. And then the third thing is that, as I alluded when I was talking about the Kimmy thing, I don't think that the way in which Suri was deposed from the game was befitting any player, but particularly a player of her stature. I thought it was bullshit, like, plain and simple. I don't think that, like, at no point should the rules get so complicated and the twists so convoluted and plentiful that you are effectively left with no options in that way. And I feel like it was treated, because it was a unique confluence of circumstances, it was treated as though, whoa, this is crazy. But it, actually, I just think it's bullshit. Like, it's in no way interesting to me. I don't really want to watch someone get excluded by mathematical possibility. That's a snore.
And if you thought us making a casual chat about Survivor last for over 3.5 hours wasn't a mathematical possibility, you were wrong, and you can come back for part 3 to learn just how wrong you were. If you do, you will hear the type of commentary that, once again, for my money, makes Taylor the best and most incisive Survivor commentator, including an in-depth tour of the fragile psyche of one Dawn Meehan, concluding with maybe the hottest and most contrarian Ko-Rong take out there. So if you want to transcend the Michelle versus Aubrey debate, and I can say that because the pun police are not here to ruin my fun, then come back for part 3. I hope to see you there, but either way, thank you for listening so far.